And I'm grateful to be sober and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Virginia and the committee for inviting me to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you tonight, which is always an honor and it's always a privilege to be asked to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love being in Texas again. I'd like to thank Mary. It's just wonderful. I get those calls and then I show up on one of those big birds, I call them, and there's someone with a smiling face standing in the airport terminal, and they say, "Are you Claire?" And I say, "Are you Mary?" And we hug, and it's like we've known each other, and that's the wonderful part of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you for your kindness, and I'm glad to be here. And if there are any new people here tonight, I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you'll keep coming back with an open mind. I celebrated a birthday day before yesterday for 23 years of continued sobriety. Thank you. From the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting in a chair, and I've had these 2 days to reflect on what I was like about 23 years ago, and I cannot believe the miracles that have happened to me, and I've come to believe in miracles because they're real and happen to those who are unafraid to believe that they're real. I can still see myself sitting in that chair that night, sick of living and scared to die. By that time, I had become a winette. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, in chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, it explains the insane things that we sometimes continue to do to keep from doing step 1, 2, and 3. And in it explains that we switched to natural wines. Well, man, I had switched to Ripple. And that's not one of your natural wines. I don't think a single grape has ever been near that stuff. I think they just put some chemicals in a bottle, and by that time I was living in the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles doing a dance with death. The problem when you're dancing with death and drinking wine out of a bottle that's still in the paper bag, somehow the music stops. And I had no idea that I was an alcoholic, and I kept thinking of all the ways that I could get the music started again. But there I was in that ghetto. I drank away everything that was precious to me, all of the families and loved ones and friends. And I had no idea in my life that I would end up sitting in an overstuffed chair with the drapes drawn and a terry cloth robe on and a bright red wig that had bangs. And I had to take my 2 younger children with me to that ghetto. And I always had that feeling of sadness because my little daughter at the time was probably 8 years old and my son was 9 and a half, maybe 10 years old at the time. And had no choice about where their drunken mother had to take them because I had lost everything else. Sitting there very often, coming out of blackouts, 10, 11 o'clock at night, listening to my heart pound like a drum. And my life was just always motivated by fear. And there were times when I would feel as if my heart was going to explode from pain. But I come from the jazz world, Boston, New York, Harlem, and L.A. And I know what you do when you're feeling that frightened. And you can hear the heart pounding and you can feel that adrenaline. And I would very often come out of those blackouts and I'd look in the mirror and that wig would be on sideways. And I knew what I needed to do was get to the nearest sleazy bar. And there are a lot of them in that ghetto area. And crawl up on a stool, because loneliness is part of our disease, I believe. And I knew if I could just have someone to talk to for a little while to quiet down that pain and let me get into the fantasies about tomorrow. Because by that time, my life was always about tomorrow. I was thinking about this recently. I remember sitting on those stools. I met a lot of out of work airline pilots. Sitting on those stools, looking in the back mirror, just like I was looking in the back mirror. And I met a few, well, neurosurgeons every once in a while. I remember one time it was this very attractive young man. He was probably in his 30s at the time. And I looked at him and smiled, and I always just needed a couple of drinks to get me started, because it just took a couple of drinks to quiet me down, that fear. And I would look around that bar and think that, you know, I was in those good old days when I was always trying to look good. And this young guy looked over at me and he smiled and he introduced himself, told me that he was a retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Air Force. I was really impressed with that one. And he looked around again and then he said, actually, he says, I'm a U-2 pilot. I fly secret missions all over the world. And he looked around again. I thought we were going to be in here for a military secret real fast. And he said, last night I flew over Russia. And I took a sip off my wine. I said, I know, darling, because I was with you. Yeah. And those are the kind of meetings I was having and on those bar stools and finding those relationships. But by the end of the evening, we were usually legends in our own heads. And I don't know what would happen between that bar and getting to that little place where I lived. I was in horrendous blackouts by this time. In the big book, it talks about the real alcoholic. And I had drank for 27 years on a daily basis. And the last 3 or 4 years of that 27 years, I was in horrendous blackouts. And I would come to, because I'm sure those new relationships of mine that I was just trying to form would dump me in the front yard because I couldn't get up a few steps that were in front of that house. And in California, in the springtime and in the summer, you know, night birds come out late at night. They come out around 11 o'clock, 11:30. 12 o'clock. They're out now. I've been here listening to them for the last couple of weeks, but what a difference. The way I listen to them now and how I used to come out of those blackouts. Spread eagle in the front yard with my face buried in wet grass. Listening to those birds calling back and forth to each other. Dogs travel in packs in that area, and late at night, they come out scrounging for food. The whole idea of the ghetto was it's all about survival. Human and animals are all trying to survive down there. And I would see this little pack of dogs going past. And they had metal trash cans in those days. And it would take several of them to push the can over into the street. And I would hear the lid begin to roll, that zinging noise, and listening to my heart. And making deals with God. When you come from the streets, you know when it's deal time. God, if you get me off the ground this morning, I'd get those, my little spill going to God that I didn't believe in. And I would see the face of that little 8-year-old daughter who used to come to me. You know, that look that children give you, and I would look in her eyes and she'd say things to me like, you know, Mom, you always promise me you're going to the PTA meeting, but you never come. All of my friends' parents show up and you get drunk. And I would look at her and I was by this time crying silent tears. And I would want to say to her, but you don't understand, dear. You know, the PTA meeting is at 7 o'clock at night. And in those days, working families went home and had dinner and the whole family went to the PTA meetings. And by 7 o'clock, I was already drunk. And I couldn't say to her, but you don't understand that when I take a drink, the drink takes me and then I give it the power because I can't stop drinking. But I pat her on the head and say, you know, next time, just let Mama know a little ahead of time. And I knew in my heart I wasn't going to be able to do that. And I'm 23 years sober by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't been to a PTA meeting yet. Because what would happen is a phenomenon of craving. The wonderful Dr. Silkworth, in his opinion, talked about the phenomenon of craving that we suffer from, because when my eyes were open, the insanity of my disease whispered and told me what I needed, and I needed a drink. Now I'm in that grass making these deals to God again. I'll even go to PTA meeting and made all those promises, get up off that ground, spin around, straighten up the wig, look around, see who's looking, try to get the dew off my shoulders. Now, I don't know about you guys, but there was a lady that lived down in that ghetto right straight across the street from me. I never knew who she was. Actually, I didn't go down there to become sociably accepted in the community. But I knew she was there because I could always see her curtains moving. And I don't think this woman ever slept. Day or night, I don't care how drunk I was, I could see these little curtains moving. And here I am spinning around out there in that yard at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. It was always so cold, and it was always so damp, and it always was so dark, and it always seemed darkest right before dawn. And I look across the street, and I see these curtains moving. And I have to get my cool look, get her the finger. Stumble up those steps and get through the door and lean on the door. And I was so sick physically, I was dying, physically, emotionally, and spiritually dying. And by that time, I was drinking my meals, and I would feel it coming, and I'd charge down that hall and get to the bathroom and get on my knees in front of the toilet bowl, do a few chin-ups on the rim, sliding around trying to find a comfortable place to rest. Sometimes passing out in a fetal position on a dirty floor early in the morning. Did you ever come out of a blackout when the room was spinning? And I would try to slow down the spin by trying to focus on something, and the two words that always greeted me was American Standard. Stamped on the bottom of that toilet, and I'd get up and break the promise. I'd promise the kids the day before, Mama's not going to go down to the liquor store tomorrow morning. And I always wanted to keep that promise. And so, but here I was. My eyes were open, and I needed a drink. So here I am getting dressed to make the run. I was 65 pounds overweight, putting on those tight jeans, putting on my bad leather jacket. By that time, I wore dark glasses all the time. Living in earthquake country, I used to sit in that overstuffed chair and worry about if there was an earthquake and if they found me and I wasn't dead and I was just injured. I didn't want them to see my eyes because my eyes were red and swollen. And the very light, it seems to me, of my very soul had gone out. So I wore the glasses all the time. Put on those starfire earrings that hung to my shoulders. And my mode of transportation by this time was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. And I just slip on my slippers and get past the door, get to that front door, open it quietly, tiptoe down those steps, feeling like a thief in the night. Cross the street, past three houses, get down on the avenue. Lean on the liquor store door and watch the world come alive. In those mornings when it was still dark out and people were going off to the work and seeing the headlights of those cars. Hey, I'd been there, done that. I drank away a successful business. I drank away the big house, the employees, and all that stuff was gone. And there I am leaning on that door wondering about those fair weather friends that I had wined and dined and bought all the love that I could afford and that didn't come down and stand with me not one cold morning. Bill Wilson, who was a co-founder of our program that I believe was divinely inspired, talked about his fair weather friends, but I'm leaning on the door wondering what happened to mine and waiting for the man to open that door so I could get in there and do a little business. I don't know what it is about clerks early in the morning in the ghetto. They really don't look like they're too happy to be there either. And so I would very often be the only customer. And if it was a good morning, I might play the little game with them. I come in from the jazz world, and I knew about the street language. I know all about street life. I still love jazz, and my favorite artist today is Randy Crawford, and she sings a song about street life. She says, if you're young, don't get old in the streets, because the cold's going to hit you in the back, and you're going to nickel and dime your life away. You're going to look back one day, it was all a masquerade, and there I was standing there very often smiling at clerks, and I had just drank away the best part of my life. And sometimes they would say things to me like, what are you going to have this morning, darling? And if it was a good morning, I'd say, well, listen, it's not for me. I have house guests. I hadn't had a guest in my house for a long time. And he'd say things like, you serve your house guests Ripple? And then I just reach over there and take it out of his hand and get out of that door and get past the little plate glass window and go around on the side of the building and lean on the building because my days for fine drinking had long been over. I didn't have to worry about bottle openers and pop cocktail napkins and stirrers and crystal glasses and the faces of smiling, handsome men. All I had to do was to unscrew the top off of that and feel it going down and spread out and quiet me down. Dr. Silkworth said that alcoholic men, we drink essentially because we like the way it makes us feel. And it would just quiet me down enough to get back to that house and sit in that chair and hear those kids go off to school. We tell our story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like today. And I really had no plans to end up to where I ended up. What I've learned about life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. I had to plan to be famous. I don't know how, you know, I wanted to be in show business. I don't know how that all happened because really I can't sing and I can't dance. I don't know. I mean, I lived in a world of fantasies. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia with wonderful parents and a wonderful loving family. My parents were not alcoholics and are not responsible for the fact that I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Silkworth talks about the threefold disease, a physical allergy, coupled with an obsession of the mind and a spiritual malady. And I'm the youngest of the seven children, and my brothers and sisters were not and are not alcoholics. I am one of the ones that I believe was born restless, irritable, and discontented right out of the chute. Probably could have had a little drinky poo, maybe in the first grade, just to get me to the second grade, because I had trouble with the world in the first grade, and I knew I never thought it was going to get any better. I always had those feelings from a very young child of the feelings of low self-worth, and I never felt adequate. I never could explain the feelings. Thank God for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I believe was spiritual in principle, that I've been able through these 23 years to go back through those steps time and time. Every year I go through the steps, and I look back and I find out, I never have found out what made me feel the way I felt. But my father was a full-blooded Native American of the Cherokee Nation, who was an artist, made a wonderful living, and we lived very well. But I had a lot of problems because I was a loner, and I just didn't seem like I fit anywhere, and I didn't fit in that school. And in Booker T. Washington High School, when I was a senior, I won an art scholarship that got me out of Atlanta. I can remember sitting on that segregated train, man, waving my finger to Atlanta. I love Atlanta today, but I mean, at the time, I was waving my finger and saying to myself, I'll never go back there again. And I didn't have to live with those rules. I have always had, even in sobriety, in my earlier sobriety, still had trouble with living with rules because I never thought they applied to me. But I didn't like the idea of that church and having to go there all the time. I didn't like the laws. I didn't like the system. And I was just delighted that I was going to go to another place. It never occurred to me. I took me with me. Same feelings, and stood on the corners in Boston, Massachusetts, because I had won a scholarship to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And I walked into that school, and I knew I didn't belong there either. And I don't know if any of you would have that feeling about, you know, tracing back over the times and feeling comfortable. I never felt comfortable till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started hooking school early on and going to the movies because I grew up in a very religious family where I wasn't allowed to do those things like go to the movies or date. I was scared to death of boys. And so I sat in the movies because I could hide there. And people wouldn't know that I didn't know anything. Here I am about 19 years old. I'd never had a date. But I could always hear this music because it was part of my life that I loved so much. Well, and I'd never seen alcohol. Georgia was a dry state when I grew up there. So I was walking down the street one night with a friend, and I heard this great music come out of a door. And I just said on a whim, let's go in there and see what they're doing. And we walk into this club, and it was a jazz club. I can still remember the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze. And down at the end of the bar was this rather portly lady grinding out this blues. And my heart just started pounding. And we walk up to the bar, and we sat on the stool. And the bartender leaned over with the kind of Pepsodent smile. And he said, what are you going to have to drink? Well, I had no idea. But I remember in the movies, they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip slick cool act. I leaned on that bar and I looked him in the eye and I said, we'll have a martini, honey. I said, and make it dry. He had no idea what a dry martini was. And he turns around and he puts these two stem glasses up there and he had this can. I now know it was a blender and he evened it out and it looked like lemonade. I didn't know you sip drinks. In Georgia, we drank a lot of lemonade in the summertime, man. It's hot down there. And I just lifted up, looked around, and dumped it. I was a pig from the gate. I remember that wonderful, warm feeling. It went down to my toes, and I looked around. I still had the glass in my hand, and I walked out on the dance floor. And I had never danced with a boy in my life, and I just looked around, and I got myself some new friends right away. I called them colorful, but the big book calls them lower companions. And I stayed out there so long, I became one of the lower companions. And I hooked up right away with the most exciting people that I could find, of course. I hooked up with the pimps, the hookers, the madams, and the bad boys. And I learned real fast how to walk the walk and how to talk the talk. I had no idea where that walk was going to take me 27 years later. But it was exciting. And I cut that school as often as I could. And I started, it got to the place that I just kind of couldn't get there. But anyway, they let me stay for quite a while, and then I just hung out in those bar stools, sitting on some stool in some jazz club. You know, I always related to Bill Wilson's part of his story, because he also was a jazz lover, and he used to frequent those jazz clubs in New York City. Well, I'm sitting there one night, and I met a nice young man who came from a similar background as I did, and he didn't know much about drinking. He didn't come from a family that drank either. So we started hanging out together and meeting up and dating, and we got married, and we had a little son, and we both loved the same lifestyle. So we were out there in those streets every night in some jazz club. Now, a lot of you are very young, and it's not about name dropping. It's just really a major part of my story and when I started my drinking career. But at the time, it was the likes of the late great legend Billie Holiday, and I could have gone in any club in those days, and Dinah Washington and Charlie Park and all Duke Ellington, all of them. Lena Horne, she's still with us, but most of them have passed on from this disease. But it was very exciting. So we both liked to do that. But we passed that little son off on the grandparents to raise. And every time I think of that, how I missed watching him grow up. And I can tell you the truth because you won't judge me. But at the time when he was just a little child, I couldn't be there because I didn't know how to be there. I had no idea what it would take to nurture a little child or another human being without a glass in my hand. And I used to have a lot of problems going to visit him, and he used to look at me when he was little. And he used to say things like, Mother, you know, the last time you came to visit me, you promised me you were going to take me to the park. But you never do keep your promise. And I'd say, I know, dear, but next time. You know, there's a paragraph in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that describes the kind of practicing alcoholic I was when it says, selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles. And it goes on in that paragraph to say that we are driven people. And we are driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And that really explained the kind of person I was, because by this time I'm hanging out with the mafia. I'm very close to the head of the Boston family. And by this time, my husband is traveling in his family's business, and I'm riding around in limousines with bodyguards. And that deep hole down inside of me just kept getting darker. I know today that that deep hole and that darkness was part of a dying soul. And I would get back down and sit on the bar stools and solve the problems of the world. And here I was just so out there in the space that I couldn't fight my way out of a paper bag. One Sunday morning, the God that I've come to believe in, I believe, would try to get my attention from time to time. Because I would go out at night when the sun went down, and I went home when the sun came up, and it was simply a lifestyle. I have learned the difference between a lifestyle and a life. Today I have a life far beyond any expectation or fantasy I ever had. And it's all because of a loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and those steps. And honoring the traditions of this program, I have learned to live in this world comfortably. And I have never been able to do that in my whole life. And I know from my own experience that I was out there looking for the kind of comfort that I have today. And I never once in my life ever wanted to get drunk. I just wanted that feeling of being just up here, but I didn't want to go any further than that, but I would always overshoot the mark. And I could never recapture that feeling of that first martini. And so I would just, I would just kept hanging out there. And one morning, on a Sunday morning, I was being driven home in this man's limousine. I called him Mr. Wonderful. I always knew that there was one out there. And it seems as if we stopped at a stoplight, and a voice said to me, "Clara, something is wrong with your life." And I agreed. The problem was Boston. If I just left Boston, things would change. So we go over and we pick up that little son who's about 10 years old and a stranger in my life. I can still feel him sitting in the back seat of that car. And that ex-husband and I were driving down Route 66, and we decided to go to L.A. With good intentions, we arrived in L.A., and we were going to be better parents to this son. And I was going to try to make up for what I had lost in my experience as a parent in being his mother, but I'm an alcoholic. I crawled up on the first bar stool. We did do some of the things we planned to do. We went into a small maintenance business that became successful, and we got all those things. You know, it was wonderful while it lasted, but my alcoholism and my drinking patterns started to get more and more. I needed more and more, and pretty soon I was out of control. My brothers and sisters had moved to the West Coast from the East Coast in New York area, and they began to watch my drinking. And I never thought I'd stand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, "Thank you, God, that you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed." It had come that time in my life when I needed to get sober. I needed to find a God of my understanding, and I simply needed to stop dying. And I had an older sister who passed away last year. Last year, she was 90 years old, but she was a nurse, and I remember going to her when it all began to hit the fan. The ex-husband left because of my violent behavior while under the influence, and it had never been the pattern with me for the earlier part of my drinking years. And he left, and we'd had two other children while we were in Los Angeles. That's that little daughter and the other little son. The older son was about 10 or 12 years older than the other two. And so he was looking at me differently than the little boy, you know, in Boston with the sad eyes. And the little tears would come in his eyes when he would always be so disappointed in me as his mother. But now we're standing outside of this house, and I asked this older sister to help me save this house. And she said, "Not this time. It pains us to watch you live the way you live. It will pain us even more to watch you die. And we're not going to do that. We're not going to sign any more checks. We're not going to bail you out of any more trouble. Thank you, God." Because I am sure my loving God was working through them to for my life at that time, and I couldn't see that. I couldn't see that. How could I see that? I didn't even believe in God, but I went back to that house, and the marshal was putting the lock on the door, and I'm standing outside, and the Internal Revenue had taken that business and sold all the equipment, and I owed the government over $20,000 on payroll taxes. And you talk about the second half of the first step, my life was totally unmanageable. And I stood outside the house, and that older son looked at me. He's probably 18 years old by now, and he said, I'm not going wherever you're going. If you go into the ghetto, I'm not going there. We don't even know who you are, and you've never been there for us. And I looked at him, if I could have said what was going on inside of my very soul would have been, but you don't understand. If I knew better, I'd do better. I'm doing the best I can. But instead, my alcoholic arrogance looked at him and said, and screw you too. Because you don't understand that, that I don't know what's wrong with me. I had spent a lot of time trying to find out simply what was wrong with me. But I just picked up that bag and went on down to that ghetto. I ended up in Daniel Freeman Hospital, which is like on the edge of the ghetto where that riot was about 3 or 4 years ago. And it's a Catholic hospital on a Sunday morning one more time. You know, being brought back to life by paramedics, people who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. How many times, you know, did I end up in those places with those people working over me? And there stood two nuns, an older nun, probably a lady in her late 60s, and a young nun, about 23 years old. I've come to believe in earth angels. Because she had on a white habit, and all I saw was this part of her face. And I share with you, her eyes were as blue as the heavens. And the tears were falling down her face on the covering of the bed. And she quietly said to me, how did you ever let your life get into such a state? And I looked up at this young nun. I had a brain concussion. All I remember until this very moment was a pair of black cowboy boots, and this right foot was kicking me in the head, and I was in the gutter on the streets. I had left the party. I remember going to the party, and that's all I remember. I had a brain concussion. I remember my hearing my ribs in and out of a blackout being cracked one at a time. I know about pain. I know about physical pain, and I know about emotional pain, and that pain has no memory. I kept living the life of the jaywalkers described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept doing insane things with insane friends and expecting a different results. They take me up with 2-inch wide adhesive tape, and 3 days later, that same young nun out of all, that's a very large hospital and a lot of nuns that are in that hospital, is this same young nun who came to dress me. You should have seen her trying to figure out how that red wig went. She kept kind of smoothing it around to find out where the bangs went. And I was in such pain, she couldn't get the jacket on, but I was bent over. And she handed me my boots, and she escorted me to the front of that hospital, and she stood there, the spiritual being that she is. I have truly come to believe that we are all born spiritual beings, and we search for our humanness in this road of life. Because that 23-year-old nun stood there with her arms around me, and she quietly said to me, try not to drink today. I shuffled down to the nearest liquor store, and it was 3 weeks later, on a dirty floor, the miracle that morning for me was that there wasn't some stranger there in that house that morning. Because the men by that time in my life had faces and no names. And I came out of a blackout in a fetal position on a dirty floor. And I heard myself crying out to that God that I didn't believe in, God, please don't let me die. And I have come to believe in the power of prayer. I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that my prayers today are answered because, you know, my prayers come from the heart, and it's no doubt in my mind that that prayer and that cry for help that morning came from my very soul. And I stood up and got up, and I remember it was still dark, and the stench of stale wine and an unkept body, because I had lost the will to care. And I wanted to die, it seems. I just couldn't even do that. And I said, God, if you just let me live today. And I didn't make any promises. And I'm glad, and I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, to those of you who are new, the only thing we promise here is sobriety. And I didn't ask for anything else. And I just said, just don't let me drink today. And I called a friend who's not an alcoholic, who's still my friend, and I told her, I said, you know, I think I'm going to die if I don't stop drinking. She said, there's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, dear. She said, and just call the operator. I'm sure they must have a phone. I hear they stay sober, but I don't know how they do it. And I waited till about 8 o'clock that morning. I picked up that phone, and I told her I wanted a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous before that morning. And she said, oh, dear, she said, I'll put you right through. And she put me right through the central office. And the man said, good morning. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you? And I said, man, my name is Claire, and I can't stop drinking. And I felt that moment of quiet that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was really a moment of truth for me. And he said, well, we don't drink in Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time. And he said, try not to drink today. And he said, we go to meetings. And he told me where the meeting was, here I am, you know, I'm overweight, I'm smelling like a bear, and I'm living on food stamps and welfare, and I say to this gentleman at central office, do you have meetings in Beverly Hills? You know where the book says the ego must be smashed? He said, we have meetings right near where you live. And he gave me the address of the meeting, and I wrote it down. And so I called my brother, who was working at Delta Airlines or at LAX at the time, and I said, I think I found a place for me, and it's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me they'll show me how to stay sober. But I need a car to get to the meeting. I hadn't had a car for a couple of years, and he said, well, sweetheart, on my way home from work this morning, he worked the night shift, and he said, I'll leave the car. And I can still hear him running up the stairs, and I was standing by the door. And I was about to go through my first day of not having a drink for the first time in 27 years. And I'm beginning to shake a little, and I opened the door, and he walked in, and he kissed me. And he said, I hope this is going to work for you. It pains us, to see you living like this. But he said, there's nothing else we can do. And you keep the car as long as you want to use it. And he left. I didn't know about detox, and I didn't know the language here. I've learned since I've been here these years that the language in Alcoholics Anonymous is indeed the language of the heart. About detoxing, I didn't know what was happening to my body. I just know it began to jerk, and I started feeling some physical pain, and perspiration was just pouring off of me. But I decided to start to get dressed, and it's around 10 o'clock in the morning. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. So I opened the closet door, and I'm peering in the closet on what to wear, because it was important for me to look good. I got one dress, and I'm staring at what to wear. And it was a red velvet dress. It had wine stains on it, and I got a little brush and some soap and water, and I cleaned up the wine stains and got that wig out and put, you know, it comes on a little head form. I got to tell you a little minute about that wig. I've been hiding out under that wig for about 5 years. It was really a rag. If that wig alone could have talked. But I got it out and clipped some better bangs and brushed it up and sprayed it with some hairspray. She was looking pretty good. And around 2 o'clock, I couldn't stand it. I didn't know. I was jerking. Have you ever been to the zoo? Years ago, when I was a little girl, my dad used to take us to the zoo on Sundays after church and after we had dinner. And In those days, the animals were kept in little cages, and they would just walk around in a little circle, and that's what I was doing in that living room. So I decided to go over to Woolworths and just browse. And while I was browsing, I stole some eyelashes for my first meeting. And they come quite long. They're about an inch and a half long, and I didn't know you're supposed to trim them down to size. So that night at 7 o'clock, I'm all dressed, and these eyelashes were the last attraction. They come with a little tube of glue. So I'm squeezing the glue along the edge of the lash, and I just can't hold it still. I'm just bouncing like a motor. And finally, I got it on, and I grab my elbow, and I wait for an opportune moment. Then I slam it in. One end's up there, and the other end's down there. I was too tired to start all over. I leaned in the mirror. I said, "You're looking good." And I went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked up that walk, and tall Scotty, who's got 30-some years now, was the greeter. He put out his hands, and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Get yourself a cup of coffee." In those days, they had real coffee cups. And I was shaking so badly, I didn't want anybody to see me, trying to hold the coffee cup because it was going all over the side. So I put it on the table, and I walked and sat in the first row in the end seat by the aisle. And I sat there shaking like a leaf. And I took a quick glimpse of my life, and I realized I had drank away the best part of my life, and I had nothing to show for it but a dying person. They started the meeting, asked for the hands of the newcomer, and I didn't know what a newcomer was. The lady behind me touched me on my shoulder, and she said, "Raise your hands, honey, because you are a newcomer." And at the coffee break, she came over to the coffee table, and I was just standing there. I had on my dark glasses, and she handed me her name and telephone number on a little piece of paper. And she said, "My name is Carol." And I took the glasses off, and I was looking at her, and I could see what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is when I look into your eyes, I see the love in your very soul. And the tears were there, and they didn't run, but I could see that she understood my pain. And that's what we do here. We share the joy, and we share the pain. She said, "Go home and call me, and I'll tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about." I got in my brother's car, and I went back to the ghetto, and I called Carol. And she told me she was going to be my sponsor. And she's my sponsor tonight. For these 23 years, she's not only been my sponsor, she's my friend, my confidant, and my spiritual teacher. She started me on the steps, and I love you all, but I love the women in Alcoholics Anonymous because they were the ones that would drive over from Beverly Hills and pick me up because I wasn't employable, and I was so sick, I couldn't work my first 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they would come over and take me to meetings, and I went from anywhere from 12 to 13 meetings, 14 meetings. And people would give me a ride home. You know, there's a part in the book that talks about, you know, the willingness to go to any lengths. And I knew when I sat in that first meeting that night that this was going to be the place for me. And I believed it then, and I believe it now, for me to go out a door outside of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and drink is for me to die. Came here with no options about what my problem was because I found out that night that I was a sick alcoholic. On that floor that morning, I believe what happened to me was a divine intervention. The God kissed me gently and said, "Child, get off the floor. You don't ever have to live like an animal again." And Carol started me on this journey with the steps. There were about 20 of us in 74, the group of 74 we called ourselves. And out of that group, five have died of natural causes. and the other 15 are still sober. Not one of us have ever gone out. We did what we were told to do right from the beginning because we were told how it works. And the old timers in those meetings were just wonderful. They were there telling us newcomers what to do. And they said, you go to a lot of meetings and you get the big book. It's a textbook and it's not a novel. And you study it. And you don't read it every once in a while. And you get yourself a sponsor and you get into action and you're guaranteed the promises. And I must tell you, you didn't lie to me because everything you said would happen to me if I was willing to do those things have come true, and I live in the promises today. We got down to doing those steps, and the fourth step with my sponsor told me to put my children's name on top of the list. And I made my amends to my kids. That older son had gone off and gone into theater training, and he was taking lessons. He got into television, and he was doing all of those things. And he moved back to Los Angeles for a short time when I guess I was around 2 years sober. And then he went east and went to New York to work. I made my amends to those kids. I did the best I could. I sat them down in a room one day, and I said, you know, I'm sorry I was never there for you. And I wish I had been, but I have learned that I was a sick person and not a bad person. And that I have choices today, and I never have to live like that again. And my kids and I, it's been an incredible journey, and I'm a double winner because my sponsor sent me to Al-Anon, and I did Al-Anon my first 5 years in learning how to adjust to being a parent for those children and for my fellows. And it was very useful and very helpful for me. Finally, my sponsor said to me, you got to get a job. I was getting better, still living in the ghetto. And I wasn't too thrilled with that news that I had to get a job. And I told her I really wasn't qualified for anything. And she said, well, I don't care. You just get a job. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. And you don't have the mafia taking care of you anymore and paying your bills. And I went and got a job as a waitress. I was a pretty bad waitress, but spilled a lot of coffee on a lot of people. Had a bad attitude. Never could see out why nobody tipped me. And I used to go to my home group. I'd bring you greetings from my home group, the Robbers and Originals. And I used to tell everybody. I used to hold up the whole meetings whining. I whined my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whining about nobody tipped me, and they told me to change my attitude, and that was helpful. And when I was sober about 3 years, I went back into the business I had lost before. And I remember the guys in my home group showed me how to get business cards made, and I would go off to Beverly Hills on Wednesday, which was my day off my waitress job, and I'd pass out this little business card asking those women in those huge mansions to let me clean their house, and I finally got a customer. And as a result of that, I did a good job, and then she recommended me to a lot of her friends and family, and pretty soon I had enough customers, I quit my waitress job, and today I have a very, very good business. I didn't have to be too proud, but I have a wonderful business for 18 and a half years now, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. I saw that little daughter of mine when I was 5 years sober go into the ice capades as the first black professional ice skater with Dorothy Hamill, and it was just exciting. The grandparents had paid for their training, and that son, that little son who had to go to the ghetto with me when I was 7 years sober, attempted suicide, and today he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got on into service because that's what my sponsor said that it was important to do, is to get into service. Things began to get better for me. I want to tell you, when I was 3 or 4 years sober, it's very dangerous to get well when you're 3 or 4 years sober, because things were going good, and I bought that little house, a lovely little Spanish house. I still live in it. I bought this big car. And I was beginning to hear the music. Dr. Silkworth talks about the insanity returning. You know, it says the book says the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against that first drink. That defense must come from a higher power. And I was doing a lot of things around the program, but I wasn't feeling any different. One Saturday afternoon, I'm dancing around my house with a broom and listening to the Billie Holiday and remembering the good old days. Isn't it something about this disease that I never remembered standing in front of the liquor store door wetting myself, but I was dancing with a broom remembering how wonderful it was when I used to go out to breakfast with Billie Holiday and drink with her and all those great stars. The phone rang and my loving God was trying to get my attention again. A woman said, Clara, and I said, yes. She said, well, I'm calling from central office, and we have a 12-step call we wish you would take. And I wasn't too happy about this idea. I said to her, where is it? She said, it's on Skid Row. I said, I don't think I'm qualified to do a 12-step call on 24. But then I'd heard you never turn down an AA request. So I got the information. I said, where is it and what do you do? And she said, well, her name is Dorothy and it's on Skid Row and it's in a hotel and it doesn't have a name outside, but it has an address. And she said, she called and she needs help. And I took all the information reluctantly and then I hung up and I called my sponsor. I said, you know, they want me to do a 12-step call down on Skid Row. And I said, I don't think I'm qualified. I gave all this stuff to her, and she wasn't saying a word. And at the end, I said, look, I don't want to do it. She said, I don't care what you don't want to do. You do it anyway. And she hung up. So I heard you never go on a 12-step call alone. So I'm sponsoring this little Hollywood actress. She had 90 days. So I pick up the phone and I call over to Beverly Hills and I said, we're going on a 12-step call. She said, where? I said, it's on Skid Row. She said, oh, I don't want to do that. I said, I don't care what you don't want to do. I said, you get over here. She comes over, we get in my car, we go downtown and we park my car and we found the address. It wasn't part of the Hilton chain, I'll tell you that. And we go into this hotel lobby, and they're dancing around, and they're all these drunks. They had a transistor radio up on this shelf, big one, a big boom box, and it was blasting, and it was romance in the lobby. And they were drunk, and they were dancing with each other. The odor of urine was all over the place. Had a red arrow along the wall pointing to a bell. Said, ring this bell for attention. I rang the bell. This guy comes out. He's the clerk. I asked for Dorothy. He said, she's on the third floor. And we talk about the 12th step. I was about to have an experience that turned my sober world around. And I realized that I was about to see the disease and how it works, and it is nothing to play with. We get on this elevator and we go down the hall and we knock on this door and this little voice said, come in. We walk into a room, and I'm not good with measurements, but it's probably 6 by 8 little room. And on the floor was a beautiful blonde young woman about 20 years old who was drowning, gagging, and almost dying on her own vomit. And she had lost her body functions. Water bugs were so huge they were crawling all over her. And when we walked around in the room, we could hear them crunching. And the stench was unbelievable. And I had an experience. I knew at that moment that God had a purpose for me. And all the ego went out of that window, and I looked down at this young woman. And we picked her up and we cleaned her up, and there was no more jokes and fun. It was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, and I learned the true meaning of that expression of one alcoholic talking to another one. We got her up and we got her down and called central office. They told us where to take her further into Skid Row, where they had a recovery house that they could accommodate 160 men and women as long as they brought them in drunk off the streets. We took her to this place and Paul got her registered, and we took her to an all-night diner that's still there as a result of that 12-step call. I've started many meetings on Skid Row, and I'm still very active in the Skid Row area, in the missions down on Skid Row. We started to try to sober up by giving her hot coffee, And we're sitting there, and she was sitting directly across from me. I started to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous like I'd never talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it really came from an inside feeling that I had never felt before. I talked about the steps, and I told her about Dr. Silkworth, and that Dr. Silkworth had given to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous the first step that came in two parts. The first part was a statement of the disease that we are powerless over alcohol. And the second half that our lives were unmanageable. And I talked about the second step that God would restore us to sanity, and she could relate to that. She talked about the insanity in her family, and they were all dying of alcohol or drug addiction. We got to the third step, and I talked about that the willingness to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. She stood up and said, "Don't you talk to me about God." I reached across the table. I think I had some unresolved anger. And I reached, we had this little pink sweater on, and I pulled her forward. I'm going to punch her lights out. The book says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, we try to carry the message. Does not say beat them up if they don't want it. And I let Dorothy go, and I would go down there every night after my business day, and for the first 2 weeks, and I went down about the 14th day, and Dorothy was gone, and I've never seen her since. But she's one of those earth angels I'm sure that God put in my path, because it turned me completely around. I got very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been that way in service. And I go to institutions, and I share on the board of directors of a halfway house, and I share in hospitals, and that's what my life is today. That son of mine had gone off to New York, had gotten a grant from ABC Television, and he was doing very well there. And he called me one day and said, "Mom, I think I'm in some kind of, I'm really in deep trouble here. My contract is almost over, and I'm going to be coming home." And what he was into is he'd gotten into shooting cocaine in the fast lane. Mine was alcohol, and his was cocaine. Sharing the needles in high places and fancy parties with fancy people. Didn't know in the early 80s, they didn't know anything about the virus. And when his contract was over, he moved back to Los Angeles, met a lovely young lady. They got married, and they moved into Northern California, where he worked as a performing arts teacher. Never touched drugs again, and the marriage didn't last, but they had a little son. I have a little grandson, and his name is Aaron. And God has given me a second chance, because I'm always there for Aaron. When Aaron comes to visit me, when he wants to go to the park, we always go to the park. I keep my promises these days. Mostly go to Toys R Us. the marriage didn't last, and they moved back to Southern California, and the son stayed up north. And then about 19 months before the earthquake in 94, I had this phone call from my son that said, "Mother, I went to the doctor today. And he said for just a simple, I wasn't feeling well, and the test came back, and I'm HIV positive." It had that time of whatever time it takes. And I was stunned. You know, it was like the wind was just knocked out of me, and I got on my knees, and I do what I do. I pray. And I said, "God, we can, and you can, because we don't know what to do." And the next day I was on a plane. I have lots of people working. I don't have to worry about that. I just took off. And I walked the streets of San Francisco with that son, with my arms around him. I sponsored a young woman when she was 8 years sober who had been diagnosed with AIDS. And she lived in one of the beach cities outside of Los Angeles. And I remember when I heard the news, getting in my car and driving down there on a Sunday morning. And we went to breakfast, and sitting in that diner, I looked at her and asked her, how did she feel about death? Because I'd always had such a terrible fear of death, and it was on the top of my fear list when my sponsor and I did a fear list. And she looked at me and she said, death is not the only the only thing about life. The greatest thing about life is you're dying when you're still alive. And I shared that with my son, that when you're still alive and you're still dying inside, I sat in a lot of chairs dying inside. And that son called me. He said, I want to stay up where I am. And then he called me, that awful call, and he said, Mother, it's time to come home because it's time for me to die. And I can't tell you what that kind of pain is about. I thought I knew what pain was about, but it isn't supposed to be that way, you know, to see your child die. And all the Earth Angels and Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor and all my sponsees, and we were around him all the time, and it came that morning at 10:15, the day before the earthquake, a week from hell, and we sang to help him cross that bridge. And that rasping sound of death, and then it's quiet. And on the nightstand was a legal pad. And when I talk about a painful heart, I picked it up. It was the only thing I knew to do. And I wrote God a letter, not a note. And I said, Dear God, if I harmed him when he was growing up and in his life, forgive me. And thank you for taking him to a better place. And then it was over. There was nothing else to say. And rooms, you know, like this, and I hear so much grief and so much about loss. And I look over the wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the wonderful Alabama Carruthers, and so many others who have passed on. I look at that and I pray that their souls rode the wings of angels to a higher place where there's no more crying and there's no more dying and there's no more pain. I want to share with you my faith in God has not eased my pain in sobriety, but my faith in God has sustained my sanity. And as long as I am sane, the presence of God is within my soul. And it's rooms like this and fellowship and angels like you that rendered me sober and rendered me sane. And for that, I am eternally grateful. And thank you for allowing me to come and share my life with you tonight. Thank you.